It's National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota connects youth who have been exploited to safe housing, resources, and non-judgmental support. Help is available 24 hours a day at 866-824-3770.
Someday, we will tell our children about this month, and they will not be able to fathom what we chose to do as a country to ourselves.
World leaders say that the U.S.-Europe relationship is forever changed. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Lowinger. Also on this week's show, we dive into the surveillance tech ICE is using, like the mobile Fortify app, which scans faces.
ICE believes a result from this app is a definitive proof of someone's immigration status and can override a birth certificate.
Plus, ICE has launched a full-throttle recruitment drive.
That seemed exactly like the methods you would use if you were trying to sell Coca-Cola, but trying to carry out the biggest mass deportation in American history.
It's all coming up after this.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. Lead pipes in public water systems are common throughout Minnesota and the country. So Hibbing Public Utilities' recent discovery of elevated lead in some samples isn't all that unique, but HPU's response is. Minnesota water providers are required to sample inside 30 homes each year. In Hibbing, 6 had lead levels above what the Environmental Protection Agency calls the lead action level. Here's Paul Plombon, HPU's energy and operations manager.
The limit for lead is 15 parts per billion. We had some that were just above that, some upwards of close to 60.
There's no safe level of lead exposure for anyone.
Anna Schleep is the Minnesota Department of Health's lead and drinking water coordinator.
We know that it can cause impacts to learning, development, behavior, hearing problems, things like that. The biggest exposure to lead is still from lead paint and lead dust. But drinking water is something that lots of people use.
Hibbing Public Utilities could have simply sent out a notice about the lead levels, done a bit of education, and addressed the issue at the homes it knew had too much lead. But instead, they chose to be aggressive. Those elevated levels came back in October. Before the ground froze, they dug about 500 potholes. That means blasting down to look at water lines on both the utility side and the customer side.
If you're not familiar with it, there's a line coming, water line coming from the house all the way out to the curb stop, and which is the shutoff for the house. And then there's usually a smaller section, depending on where the water main is, that is utility owned, and that goes out to the main.
Before that, HPU knew about 8 or 9 lead lines. The potholing upped that count to about 90. Service lines are the main way that lead gets into water in Minnesota. Lead solder and fixtures are big sources, too. That means even homes with well water can still have lead. Anytime water sits, lead can leach in. Concerns around lead poisoning really started to grow in the 70s. New lead plumbing was banned in 1986. The health department's Spleach says there's been a lot of work to lower lead exposure in those decades. For a long time, the focus was on corrosion control to minimize lead in water. In 2021, the EPA changed its lead and copper rules, adding requirements to identify and replace lead service lines. Minnesota's goal is to replace all these lines by 2033.
But our general manager is confident we can do ours in 2 to 3 years.
Most Minnesota water systems, including Hibbing, are still in the identification phase. That's evident when you look at the state's online map of lead service line inventories. There, you can check each water system to see how many lines are lead. Hibbing has about 6,000 service lines. The type of about 1/3 are still unknown. Customers are often hesitant to let people into their homes, but HPU has been more aggressive about that, too. In the last week, they've looked at some 150 lines. It's a slow process, but getting inside homes to help identify those lines is a big focus this winter.
This customer side, being able to complete this is a really high priority because that will help inform the rest of our potholing projects.
Elliot Dixon is HPU's engagement specialist.
And so, you know, they feed into each other to make sure that we're making the best decisions we can, putting the funding in the most effective place possible for these upcoming replacement projects as well.
The cost of the work is prohibitive for a lot of communities. The state provides some funding, but that's part of the reason behind Hibbing's aggressive approach. More data to back up the need for additional money means they could get more to help pay for replacements.
If you want to look at it like this, Hibbing is more standing up for the little guy. And if we have to be the voice of reason and be down at the state capitol and in Washington, D.C., talking about this, spreading the word of what we're doing, helping other communities if we can. And even if it helps just by being down there and being the squeaky wheel and saying they're not going to go away until we give them something and help them out, then we're okay with that.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Michael Loewinger.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, Donald Trump seemed to reverse course on Greenland.
The president tonight in the heart of Europe abruptly backing off two bold threats regarding his ongoing quest to control Greenland, tariffs and military action, posting he's reached a framework of a future deal with the Secretary General of NATO. But when pressed, providing no further details.
This mere hours after Trump's address at the World Economic Forum in Davos, in which he rambled on, sometimes incoherently, sometimes threateningly, about how the U.S. needs to own Greenland.
All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland.
We want a piece of ice for world protection, and they won't give it. They have a choice. You can say yes, and we will be very appreciative, or you can say no, and we will remember.
Greenland is, of course, part of Denmark, a U.S. ally and member of NATO. Thus, Trump, with his rumbling and whining, threatens to upend a mutual defense contract and solid alliance between the U.S., much of Europe, and Canada that's been a shield and a hedge against aggression since 1949. Now, Denmark has sent troops to the island in the high north to defend against Trump's imperial ambitions. And this week at Davos, we saw America's once staunchest allies basically say, it's over.
We will only be able to capitalize on this opportunity if we recognize that this change is permanent.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Of course, nostalgia is part of our human story, but nostalgia will not bring back the old order.
We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney.
That the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient. That trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful. And American hegemony in particular helped provide public goods, open sea lanes, a stable financial system, collective security, and support for frameworks for resolving disputes. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition.
Garrett M. Graff is a journalist and historian and author of a recent piece in Wired titled, We Are Witnessing the Self-Immolation of an Empire.
Since he came to office a year ago, Donald Trump has set about consciously dismantling what to me are the six core sources of national strength and influence for the United States on the world stage.
Right. You call them the six pillars. Just go through them all.
The first is easy access of immigrants to the United States and the pull of foreign students to our world-class schools and universities.
Okay, now let's go to the second pillar. Rich and steady government support of higher education, medical research, and laboratories.
And of course, it's very related to that first pillar how we have these world-class schools and why they attract the very best talent from all over the world.
And the third pillar?
The whole story of growth of the economy in the last 50 years has been the story of broad trade access to U.S. markets and reciprocally a flow of U.S. products to the rest of the world, lowering trade barriers and making the global economy ever more frictionless.
The fourth one is an unyielding and unquestionable adherence to the rule of law at home.
The rule of law in the United States had been so firmly established. The idea of a fascist government secret police, that a president would be using the Justice Department to punish political enemies, that business leaders would actually have to think about their standing with the president personally to decide whether they could move forward with a corporate merger or bribe the president personally in order to be able to continue doing business. This is something that until even just a year ago seemed unthinkable to even mention.
Likewise, this would be the fifth pillar, a firm, unyielding, and unquestionable network of geopolitical alliances that knit a security blanket across the entire globe.
That has been really the bedrock of U.S. foreign policy going back to the end of World War II. We emerged from that war in this moment where, like, we don't want a world war to ever happen again. And we are going to build the network of global institutions to help ensure that problems going forward are solved with diplomacy and not military might. And we stood up these institutions like NATO, like the United Nations, like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to try to make this world safer, more stable, and more secure.
You have a sixth pillar.
Yes, and all five of these pillars come together to firm up another equally critical pillar. A politically independent and fiscally prudent monetary policy that established the U.S. dollar as the world's safest reserve currency, made U.S. Treasury bonds the savings bank for the entire world, and made U.S. banking networks and capital markets the place to be for any company looking for access to investors. You look at all six of these things, and Donald Trump has done irreparable damage to all six of these.
Has this happened before in American history?
Countries have made mistakes. Empires rise and fall as technology changes, as geopolitics change. You can point to Napoleon making the disastrous decision to invade Russia. You can talk about the decisions of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the start of World War I. But no country in the modern history of the nation state has chosen to commit suicide by its own choice, undermining its core sources of national strength.
Can we stipulate, though, that this rules-based order, as we call it, hasn't worked for everybody, and America has played fast and loose with its tenets over and over again? This is something that Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney emphasized in his speech, that there were a lot of things where participants in the rules-based order just pretended not to see.
This world order has seen huge tragedy. The Cold War was felt acutely by people in countries like Vietnam and Cambodia. I mean, the United States has been a hugely destabilizing force in Latin America and Central America. There are all sorts of problems with America atop the world order.
The end of the Cold War weakened American power because nations didn't have to compromise their individual interests as much to get under America's security umbrella. I mean, we know that America did some awful things. Maybe we had it coming.
There is an entirely cogent argument that one could make that the world was due for a reshuffling of that world order. What to me is so stunning about this particular moment, though, is the idea that America is doing this of our own accord, that we are forcing these other countries to look elsewhere for peace, strength, and stability because we are ceding that ground to Europe, to China, to no one. You look at Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, and they just must be gleeful watching Donald Trump's actions over the last year. This week in Davos, China is right there pitching itself to Europe and the world beyond to help pick up the pieces of this broken American century and leadership role.
Trump is not entirely without friends. He, on Thursday, inaugurated his Board of Peace. He is the head of it for life. The countries that have joined, 21 so far, had to, I guess, kick in $1 billion as a kind of membership fee. Among the 21 countries are Belarus, Hungary, Israel, Pakistan, Turkey.
It is a stunningly unimpressive list of the countries that historically America has most held its nose while doing business with. These are sort of, for the most part, our most uncomfortable allies.
Not to Trump personally.
Not to Trump personally. That's the one uniting characteristic of everything that we are watching Donald Trump do. From tearing down the East Wing and building a ballroom to building the Trump Arch in Washington.
Not to mention the Kennedy Center.
All of these things are about trying to build a legacy that so changes the arc of the world that it cannot be undone.
Which brings us inevitably to the question, can this be undone? Or is it, as many European leaders said this past week, it's just over? You know, as Gramsci famously said, the old world is gone, the new world is yet to begin, and in the interregnum, there is much morbidity. Is it just over?
That's the heartbreak of this, Brooke. I think that this world is gone. We could elect a whole string of presidents going forward who believe in NATO and invest in NATO, who try to restart USAID, who try to lure the best foreign students back to the United States to do research at our universities, to rebuild the trust in the Justice Department. And I think whether you're a potential immigrant to the United States, whether you're a corporate leader in the United States or abroad, or you're the head of state of a foreign country, in the back of your mind is always going to be the United States is only one election away from a Donald Trump again. You know, I closed my Wired piece talking about the famous opening of historian Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August, her book about World War I. She opens with the grand funeral of England's Edward VII in May of 1910. This fabulously colorful parade of mourning that brought together 9 kings, 7 queens, and 40 more imperial and royal highnesses. And what none of them realized in that moment was that was really the high point and last gasp of the grand era of geopolitical dominance and sort of the peak of the colonial powers of Europe, which over the rest of that decade, you know, destroyed itself in the trenches and poppy fields of the First World War and ceded control of that world that they had inherited and led for a century to the upstart America across the Atlantic Ocean. That was the moment that our century really began. And someday we will tell our children about this month of January 2026 in world politics, and they will not be able to fathom what we chose to do as a country to ourselves. and they will never be able to contemplate what the United States once meant to the world beyond, because the relationship of the United States to the rest of the world has been so fundamentally altered by this last year.
I want to go back and ask you a couple of things that I sort of skipped over.
The complete collapse of the world order and we missed a subject or two? I don't believe it.
How much of NATO's power rested on belief in the liberal rules-based order that is crumbling?
That's all an alliance really is, Brooke. It's the promise that when you need me, I will be there. The moment that Denmark or any of these other European nations is now facing down Russia in Europe and has to sort of every so often start to turn around and check over its shoulder whether the U.S. is an adversary or an ally, the whole promise collapses.
Can Europe recreate a system of stability that the world can rely on the way that the U.S. once did?
I think it could, absolutely. This is what the grand European experiment of the last 80 years has been. You know, the creation of the European Union, the creation of the Euro, the European Commission, and the European global market.
It certainly hasn't been smooth sailing.
It has not been smooth sailing, but it has been a world struggling to be born. You know, a vision for a future for a united Europe. But even that is under its own threat. I mean, we saw Brexit the same time that Donald Trump was elected the first time. We've seen how devastating that has been politically and economically to the United Kingdom. So that's not to say that, you know, Europe can't pull it together and build something new, but Europe on its own will never be as powerful as Europe and the United States and North America was together. And from the U.S. perspective, one of the things we really need to worry about is when Europe looks around for its partners going forward, Europe and China could be an incredibly powerful partnership for the 21st century that leaves the U.S. sitting on the sidelines.
Europe could take the opportunity to say, wow, that was 80 years of bullying. To hell with you guys.
A lot of my work is as a World War II historian. And to me, part of this is the story of where we are exactly 80 years after the end of World War II. That we are losing the last of the greatest generation who fought and won World War II. The last of the generation who understood how hard this world was to build the first time, to fight against fascism and to root out fascism once it took hold in the continent of Europe, and how much work it took to build these international institutions. The baby boomers have spent effectively all of their lives growing up under the umbrella of peace, security, stability, and economic success given by this policy recipe. What I really worry about is these decisions being made by policymakers who don't understand the high cost it took to achieve this level of peace, security, and economic prosperity, and are willing to burn it all down now for Donald Trump's own ego and narcissism without worrying about what comes next.
Garrett, thank you very much.
I would say, Brooke, it's always a pleasure, but this is a pretty depressing conversation.
Garrett M. Graff is a journalist and historian and author of the newsletter Doomsday Scenario. His recent piece in Wired is called We Are Witnessing the Self-Immolation of a Superpower.
Coming up, Minnesotans are bundling up against the cold and ice.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering both virtual and hybrid positions with opportunities for career growth, pay increases, and healthcare benefits. More information and applications are available at careers.progressive.com. and by Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at SEED.com/public.
You're listening to On the Media here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, January 26th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you're interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234 to learn about sponsorship opportunities. Big thanks goes out to all of our current business supporters. And now we're going to take you back to On the Media here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Loewinger. There was news out of Congress this Thursday.
To Washington, D.C. tonight, where the House passed a package of spending bills to keep the government open.
In the end, seven Democrats crossing party lines to vote with Republicans to fund the Department of Homeland Security, which of course includes Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE.
And out of the North Star State on Friday.
In Minnesota, organizers of a statewide economic blackout are urging people to stay home from work and school and to close businesses in protest of the ongoing immigration enforcement surge happening there.
Lawful law enforcement operations. That's what's been happening on the ground in Minnesota.
Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt responding to anti-ICE narratives earlier this month.
These are illegal alien criminal pedophiles, murderers, rapists, some of the worst criminals who...
According to a new poll from CBS last week, the majority of Americans, 56%, do not believe that ICE is prioritizing criminals for deportation. And while there's not much recent data, arrest records reviewed by the New York Times in 2025 are clear. Only about 7% of ICE detainees have a violent conviction, and about two-thirds have no criminal record at all. On Tuesday, a child was picked up by ICE agents in his family's driveway.
5-year-old Liam Ramos is seen wearing a Spider-Man backpack near his home as a masked agent stands behind him.
The agent took the child out of the still-running car, led him to the door, and directed him to knock on the door, asking to be let in order to see if anyone else was home, essentially using a 5-year-old as bait.
But of course, the cruelty is not limited to non-citizens.
Not allowed. This is private property. You're not allowed. I'm from this country.
That's U.S. citizen Ramon Minera, a resident of Columbia Heights, Minnesota, who was detained last week by ICE.
You know what, sir? Now talking to you, seeing, hearing that you have an accent, I have reason to believe that you are not born of this country.
So you're just based on accent?
Look, sir, are you going to do this the easy way, or are we going to take you in?
This is what legal observers call a Kavanaugh stop. A term named after the Supreme Court justice who wrote an opinion in September essentially greenlighting ICE's power to racially profile suspects.
What we're hearing is they're being stopped in traffic stops or on the street with no cause and being forced to demand paperwork to determine if they are here legally.
Police Chief Mark Brule of Brooklyn Park, a city in Minnesota.
We started hearing from our police officers the same complaints as they fell victim to this while off duty. Every one of these individuals is a person of color who has had this happen to them.
If it's happening to cops, you know it's bad. And there's reason to believe that it's even worse than we thought. This week, we learned that ICE agents had been secretly instructed that their work doesn't need to follow the Fourth Amendment, which protects people from unreasonable search and seizure by the government.
According to a memo from the acting ICE director obtained by the Associated Press, immigration officers can enter homes without a judicial warrant.
Which helps explain what happened to U.S. citizen Chong Li Tao, a Hmong immigrant, earlier this week.
An Asian American grandfather who was speaking out after being dragged out of his home by federal officers Sunday in St. Paul without any clothes on into the freezing cold after agents broke into his home without a warrant.
ICE officers say they detained Tao while searching for two registered sex offenders. But as the Associated Press reported, according to a public registry, Tao has no such record, nor does anyone living on his block. Considering how violently and, well, erroneously federal agents have targeted people, it's worth digging into how exactly ICE chooses which homes to raid. According to Joseph Cox of 404 Media, an independent tech outlet, the agency has been quietly amassing an arsenal of surveillance tools. He began by telling me about Tangles and Weblock, two applications made by a company called Penlink, which now help guide officers around cities like Minneapolis.
The one that's a lot more interesting to me is the one called Weblock. And this allows ICE to look at all of the phones it may have data on in a particular neighborhood. Now, usually when ICE would need phone location data, maybe they would get a warrant and they would go to AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile and get the data that way. With Weblock, they don't need a warrant at all. They're just buying the data.
From what I understand, an app like Weblock can basically purchase data that people are maybe unknowingly already giving to apps that they use for very pedestrian things like Candy Crush or Tinder or MyFitnessPal. How does that work?
Yeah, unknowingly is the key thing here, because I doubt that many people know this is going on. So whenever an ad is about to be placed in front of you inside an app, there is this near instantaneous and pretty much invisible process going on where all of these companies are trying to outbid one another to get their ads in front of a certain demographic. So males who are 18 to 35, who live in this part of Los Angeles or whatever. That's very normal. That is just how online advertising works, especially in the United States. A side product is that you have these companies, such as Penlink, hoovering up all of that data. And that can include the location data of mobile phones. Sometimes spy firms will buy an advertising company to gain access to this. Sometimes they will take one over. Other times they'll misrepresent and gain access to the data that way. But the result is that they hoover up all of this information. They add additional information to it to make it more useful to the authorities, put it in a very nice searchable interface, and then sell it to ICE.
So then when ICE is using Weblock, what are they looking at?
You'd say, I want to see all of the phones in this part of Los Angeles at this time and this date. From there, a map will appear on their screen. They will then draw a shape like a circle, and it will immediately show all of the phones that Weblock has data on for that location at that time. They can then click these interesting and novel features, such as the route button, which will show the exact path a phone took to either get to that location or to leave it. You could see the exact highway that that phone took to get to where the person presumably lives.
How does this not run afoul of the Fourth Amendment, which requires law enforcement to get warrants before searching?
Yeah, this is a basic tenet of the U.S. justice system in that law enforcement have to get a warrant or, you know, potentially some sort of other court order to protect people from unreasonable search and seizures. That's why law enforcement needs to get a warrant to go to AT&T or Verizon to get location data. That changes when the government buys the data, essentially. And this is according to an internal legal analysis from Inside ICE that was shared with me by the ACLU. ICE believes that people are willingly giving up this location data from their phone because they could turn off location services. They could uninstall the apps which are selling their location data, and that's the legal basis they have.
That feels like such a technical cop-out. It's like, well, the terms of service were there. You just didn't read 30 pages of legalese before you downloaded Tinder. It's maybe technically true, but I mean, give me a break.
But even then, some companies who harvest and sell location data say, yes, we will opt you out. And even when you do that, they still gather location data and they still sell it. So even if somebody is very well informed, even then, the location data may still be gathered. And these people have not provided informed consent.
Okay, let's talk about another app that ICE has been using. Mobile Fortify. This is facial recognition software that allows the user to take a picture of someone and then real time bring up some of their information. It's the same tech that Customs and Border Patrol use at the airport.
So I first learned about Mobile Fortify last June through emails, links from Inside ICE. I'm then trying to find evidence of it actually being used on American streets. And slowly, I get this trickle of videos on social media. And it's not always clear what is going on. But ICE or Customs and Border Protection officials will point their phone directly at someone's face and then they'll go look at the screen. Now, you may think, well, they could just be taking that person's photo or something like that.
And recording a recruitment reel or something, right?
Exactly. But then in some of the videos, I started to notice the officers saying something explicit.
An ID? You got something that you can show?
Nah, me? I mean, I have school ID.
Let me see that.
I was born here, but I don't got ID.
You don't have no ID?
No.
Can you do facial?
Can we do facial? Which to me was a clear acknowledgement that they were doing facial recognition.
Last year in Oregon, an agent took two pictures of a 45-year-old woman ICE had detained after a raid. The app came back with two different names for this woman and they arrested her anyway.
Yeah, the first thing you learn about facial recognition is that it's not always accurate. And in fact, with people of color, especially black people, we've seen multiple cases of that. It can repeatedly misidentify people who have been arrested and detained, even charged, even though there was a mistake in the facial recognition technology. This case you're referring to, it's a woman who goes by the initials MJMA in the court transcript that I obtained. She was swept up in an immigration raid in Oregon. Her and around 30 other people were detained. And in this testimony from a Customs and Border Protection official that I got, the official admits that they took two different photos using the Mobile Fortify app of this woman. Both times, it returned different names. Now, logically, I'm thinking, well, at least one of those has to be wrong. People yes. do not have two names. So we were going to publish an article on that. And then I managed to get in touch with the lawyer representing her, and he said that both of the names were incorrect.
And yet they still detained her.
Yes, I would say, though, they were detaining her probably anyway. It was part of this larger sweep of this apartment complex, and there was a van involved, and she was in the driver's seat and that sort of thing. So from my read of the testimony, she was probably going to be detained anyway. That being said, this app, Mobile Fortify, this is what ICE is using to identify people in the field. We've seen multiple videos on social media of ICE or other DHS officials going up, pointing their phone at people. ICE believes a result from this app is a definitive proof of someone's immigration status and can override a birth certificate. I don't know how the agency can say that when it's giving a woman two different names.
Each one of these examples is like raising my blood pressure even more. But let's talk about another tool that ICE is using called Enhanced Leads Identification and Targeting for Enforcement, or ELITE. Weblock and Tangles were already in existence that not just the government are using, but ELITE is an app that was created specifically for use by the government by Palantir. This is the surveillance company co-founded by Peter Thiel. What does ELITE do? You actually looked at an official handbook for the app.
It is, again, a map interface, and it will show icons signifying all of the potential immigrants in that area. You then click on a particular person. It will bring up their individual dossier, their name, date of birth, a photo if they have it, and crucially for ICE, their address and an address confidence score. Addresses to them are gold because it gives them a specific location to raid. And even if they don't necessarily find the specific person there, they're also doing it just to find densely populated neighborhoods where they think a lot of people they might be able to detain will be located.
You said that ELITE will note the source of the address, such as the government agency that supplied it. Which government agencies do we know are giving addresses and similar data to ICE?
Yeah, so the user guide I obtained for ELITE lists a few different government agencies. The first is the Department of Health and Human Services. There is also mention of United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, obviously part of DHS. There is a mention of something called CLEAR in all capital letters. I believe that may relate to a data product from Thomson Reuters. That company has not responded to my request for comment, but they have contracted with ICE repeatedly and sold them data before.
Is this the parent company of the news organization Reuters?
Yes, as well as being a news organization, Thomson Reuters has a data product that they will sell to private industry and many government agencies as well. And we've reported before that ICE is able to take, say, license plate data from Motorola, for instance, and it pairs it, or it can pair it, with data from Clear. And that can be people's addresses, personal information, all of that sort of thing. But I would stress that this user guide, it's not an exhaustive list of all of the data sources that Elite may be getting. It just says somewhere around the end of the list, it's integrating new data sources. So I fully expect that there could be more that we just don't know about.
The fact that this rogue agency is using shady and at times frighteningly inaccurate apps to skirt laws, that feels like it should be a very big concern for lawmakers, at least the ones who still care about basic civil liberties. If and when Congress were to do something about it, what would be the first step towards new privacy legislation?
Well, there's a few things. Democratic lawmakers have acted on this in some capacity, or they have tried to act on it. You have Senator Ron Wyden introduced the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act a while ago, and that would have banned agencies from simply buying data. They would have to get a warrant or some other legal mechanism. So that would stop the stuff like Weblock and Tangles and that sort of thing. Another one, Rep. Thompson, who recently with other Democratic lawmakers, I think a group of six of them, introduced potential legislation that would rein in Mobile Fortify, the ICE facial recognition app, saying it can only be used at ports of entry, you can't roll it out to local police, which is what DHS was trying to do as well. So, you know, potentially there's some room there for legislative action as well. But more fundamentally, the United States does not have a federal privacy law. You have a law in California doing its thing. I think you have one in Illinois around biometric data. Of course, in the EU, you have GDPR, a very overarching, all-encompassing data protection regulation. The US just does not have that, which is what partly allows the country and agencies to just buy information on its citizens and residents.
You and your team at 404 Media have done incredible work on this story, on this beat. I am surprised it's not being covered more, frankly. Why do you think these surveillance efforts are so poorly understood to this point?
The coverage question is a really interesting one. When you cover this, there is a danger that you present it to the reader, some abstract problem over there with some tech company making some tool in the distance. That is why I think there is relatively little coverage around the tech powering ICE. You have to show this is how this technological product is impacting people in this city or on the ground. But I think we're breaking through with a few overarching stories. After I first revealed that Fortify existed last June, we eventually found all those social media videos of ICE actually using it. And now it was concrete and people could understand it. They could literally see it with their own eyes. And the other one is this new Palantir system called Elite, where I think that is finally providing a through line in between Palantir, the obscure, strange tech company that everybody has heard of, but nobody really knows what it does, and what is actually happening on the ground with ICE. I think we've made that link, and I'm sure many other journalists will as well.
Joseph, thanks for doing this work.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Joseph Cox is an investigative reporter and co-founder of 404 Media.
Coming up, it's hard to avoid seeing those ICE recruitment ads your tax dollars are paying for.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of a company into one simple business management platform. More information at odoo.com.
This is People Powered KAXE, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Micah Loewinger. ICE's ability to upgrade their technology, in part, came from a dramatically upgraded budget. Last July, in the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, Congress tripled ICE's annual budget from about $10 billion to roughly $30 billion. Another line item for those expanded coffers? What the agency calls wartime recruitment. A task granted roughly $100 million. Drew Harwell is a technology reporter for The Washington Post. He and his colleagues obtained a variety of files from ICE employees about the effort, including one called a Surge Hiring Marketing Strategy document, which lays out in very precise detail all the ways ICE wants to solicit new recruits, including producing a ton of ads.
The ads are broken up a couple different ways. One, you have the classic kind of Americana nostalgia ads that basically read like propaganda from World War I. You know, white people on the frontier fighting these invaders. Uncle Sam features prominently. Then you have this other kind of mix that's this very modern, meme-y, edgy kind of campaign that's all action movie posters, video games, the Halo video game features prominently. It makes this policy issue of immigration into this game, this battle.
But just to like zoom in on the Halo ad, on the Department of Homeland Security's Instagram, we saw an image with the words, "Destroy the Flood." For those who haven't played Halo, which is a hugely popular video game series, humans are basically fighting a parasitic alien called the Flood that takes over living things and turns them into zombies. I mean, this is like an extremely dehumanizing lens through which to talk about non-citizens. And I want to get to who these ideal recruits are. It's not just Gen Z, and it's not just on Instagram. Up until recently, you could hear ads running on Spotify.
In too many cities, dangerous illegals walk free as police are forced to stand down. Join ICE and help us catch the worst of the worst.
You can see recruitment ads on local TV across the country.
Join the mission to protect America with bonuses up to $50,000 and generous benefits.
You can find similar ads on Hulu, HBO Max, Snapchat, YouTube.
Yeah, and I remember growing up seeing the military Army of One ads that made a similar point where you could be the knight on the front lines, and there were TV commercials. Now, you know, these ads are everywhere.
So pervasive that SNL did a sketch last October with Tina Fey as Christy Noem and Amy Poehler as Pam Bondi.
Do you need a job now?
Yeah.
Are you a big tough guy?
Yeah.
Tough enough for the army or police?
No.
But do you take supplements that you bought at a gas station?
Daily.
Do you like to use zip ties because people in your life don't trust you with keys?
You know it.
Then buckle up and slap on some Oakley's, big boy. Welcome to ICE.
I think it's worth mentioning that after that sketch, the DHS X account clipped like the first 10 seconds of it to make another ad, which raises something kind of odd about what ICE is up to. The New Yorker reported this month that the Department of Homeland Security has repeatedly used pop songs over some of its recruitment ads by artists like Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and even a SZA parody song from an appearance on SNL. You'll hear this music over footage of ICE arrests. Rodrigo, Carpenter, and SZA have denounced these videos as hateful, evil, and quote-unquote peak dark, respectively. But it kind of seems like ICE is thriving off of these responses, intentionally trolling famous people to try to drive more headlines and virality.
clearly. And, you know, we had gotten some internal messages from ICE where they talk about, well, we don't really have the rights to this music. Maybe it's not the best idea. And members of the ICE team who's putting these out basically say they don't care. This has been something that administration has been very clear about. They like trolling the libs. They like being out there smashing people in the face every day. They want to go viral. People who agree with it tend to share it because they think it's funny. People who hate it and despise it share it as well to show their disgust. To the algorithm, it's all the same. I think the big question is whether any of this actually works. General polls of people's sentiment toward Trump's immigration policy, he's way underwater. The social media campaign of being very aggressive and in your face, it hasn't reversed that, right? It hasn't made people as a whole support Trump's immigration policy. Maybe the strategy is being driven by very online people who love trolling, people love being edgy, but is that actually good policy for government?
And what are the implications here? It kind of feels like 4chan marketing for people who also grew up on 4chan. I'm thinking of one of these ads The Intercept reported on that ICE posted just 2 days after Jonathan Ross shot and killed Renee Good in Minneapolis. It's an image on the Department of Homeland Security's Instagram that reads, "We'll have our home again," which is just innocuous nativist language until you realize that that phrase is the title of a song by a group called Pine Tree Riots that's been embraced in neo-Nazi spaces online for quite some time. And the lyrics to that song were the opening to a manifesto posted by a white supremacist who in 2023 shot up a Florida Dollar General and killed 3 black people. Why post that dog whistle if you're not trying actively to recruit white supremacists?
There's been enough of these examples now that it's impossible to say that this is all coincidental. DHS and ICE, when we have brought this stuff up to them, they have said, oh, you're going to the Nazi thing again. How tiring. But it doesn't really explain why this keeps happening. You don't just
accidentally use Nazi songs,
trip over your feet and accidentally use far right dog whistle memes. I think part of it is that some of these people come from Republican policy shops, Republican press shops that were very online. They came up into this environment where they were young edgelords, right? Part of what this document suggested also was that they were going to be going to pro-ICE influencers, so creators on Rumble and Snapchat and YouTube and Instagram, paying them money to get the message out about recruiting. So there's definitely a big online component. The part that really jumped out to me and felt interesting was how they've moved into the real world, where they're using techniques like geofencing, where they look at a real world place like rodeos, gun shows, UFC fights, NASCAR races, hunting shows. They're drawing basically a circle around these areas. Anybody who sets foot into those events is going to get a pop-up ad on their phone. They're also doing billboards and bus stops. So it really struck me as a pretty sophisticated effort. I talked to marketing experts who do this for real companies, and they felt it seemed exactly like the kinds of methods you would if you were trying to sell Coca-Cola, but they're applying it to this government agency that's trying to carry out the biggest mass deportation in American history.
Because they believe that the people attending these types of events are their prime demographic.
Yeah, in the document, they talk about their target market being people who are conservative, people who see themselves as patriots, people who listen to patriotic right-wing podcasts, but also people interested in military affairs, guns and tactical gear, people who are really into watching fitness influencers. Some of this is not super new. ICE has traditionally, when they've wanted to backfill positions that they've lost to attrition or retirement, they've often got people who have trained as cops and local police departments and sheriff's offices who want a federal job. But they need so many people now. They're trying to cast a really wide net and going after people who may not have the training and may just be some guy scrolling social media.
What evidence do we have that DHS is not being so judicious in who they allow into the ranks?
There has been some reporting on this, especially by people like Nick Miroff at The Atlantic, where they've said they're getting a lot of applications in and they're getting a lot of people who are expressing interest in these jobs, specifically because ICE is offering $50,000 signing bonuses.
and help with student loans.
Student loan reimbursement programs. They're basically throwing money at new applicants. And ICE is telling us this advertising campaign is working. They're getting all the applications they need, 100,000 or more applications. And yet, the reporting from people like Nick Miroff and the Washington Post as well has found that people are coming in, they're not able to pass the fitness requirements. They're hitting all kinds of roadblocks in terms of the testing. We talked to people who are former DHS ICE officials. They've said they're shifting the bar to a point where they're bringing in people who are not going to be great candidates.
In fact, there was that viral story from independent journalist Lara Jadid, who wrote about how she was allegedly hired by ICE after visiting a career fair in Texas last summer. Here she is on Democracy Now.
I went in, I handed in my resume, which was, I did a skills-based resume. I'm a veteran. I served 2 tours in Afghanistan. So on the surface, their resume looked pretty good. Had a very brief interview, took all of 6 minutes. Then I left, assuming I would never hear back, because I'm a very Googleable person. I'm the only Lara Jadid on the internet, and I make no secret of how I feel about ICE and Trump. And
she goes on to say that she initially missed the email from ICE and never filled out the paperwork that they requested with that offer, stuff like a background check or an affidavit, saying she'd never committed domestic crimes. But then, a few weeks later, she says, I got a message from LabCorp saying that ICE wanted me to do a drug test.
And then 9 days after that, you know, I was just curious, had they processed the drug test yet? So I logged onto the ICE hiring portal, and not only did the drug test not seem to be relevant, I was listed as having joined ICE as of 3 days earlier.
Which is wild to me because she has reported critically on this agency for a long time. So if the agency would not look into the most superficial information about this potential recruit, what are they missing from everybody else?
You mentioned that poll numbers would have us believe that there's actually a sizable backlash to ICE's activity across the country. That said, DHS is claiming big new numbers, upwards of 220,000 job applications in 5 months. Does that seem legit to you?
You know, it's their numbers. I don't have any reason not to trust them. You know, number of applications is not necessarily a proxy for perfect candidates who are being hired, right? Some of these might be repeat applications. Some of these might be applications that don't work. And again, some of this is probably a reflection of the $50,000 signing bonuses. I mean, some of these deportation officer jobs pay $50,000 salary. So you're basically doubling the salary year one. I think it's impossible to disentangle the success of this kind of recruitment strategy from the actual advertising. We just don't know if one is connecting to the other.
So many of these examples are incredibly dark. I guess I'm trying to make sense of what it means exactly.
I think for me, what I'm left with is just this shifting on what we find is acceptable as a way to talk about these things. Like the tone with which the government is discussing getting shock troopers in to enforce the border laws and kick people out of the country. These are policies that are, again, life or death issues that one would hope would be discussed seriously in a sober way. Maybe that's too much to ask. How much the 4chan culture and the edginess of the internet, how dark it is and nihilistic, how much it has bled into public affairs and how much has consumed media and politics in this country. If we're talking about deportation in this way on the internet, the people who are setting policy are going to be seeing this, and they're going to be finding it acceptable to talk about the job in this way. I just think it's a leading indicator of how this policy is shaped in our country.
Drew, thanks for doing this reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Drew Harwell is a technology reporter for The Washington Post. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Molly Rosen, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Candace Wong. Travis Mannin is our video producer.
Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, with engineering from Jared Paul. Eloise Blondio is our senior producer, and our executive producer is Katya Rogers. On the Media is produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Loewinger.
This is Megan Buffington, reporter for KAXE's news team. I have a book of poetry published by the League of Minnesota Poets in 1944, and I want to share a few snippets with you. Here's part of The Mississippi by Clement Wood. Old Man River rises in Itasca, rises in 10,000 lakes, aiming for the sea. Cass, Winnebagoshish, gem-like Pokegama, flowing so the land's rain can at last be free. Old Man River, born in Minnesota, just beneath the Lake of the Woods, the land's northernmost reach, never forgets the state of his birth, never ceases dreaming of bright lakes and big woods, oak, maple, beech. Old Man River, as the gray skies open, rains into his lakes again, far from gulf and sea, and the glad land's voice whispers the soft message.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with translator K210DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota. North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota.